Okay, well, it's 1 o'clock, so I think we should go ahead and get started. Thank you for coming. I think we have a very good panel. Flooding, droughts, and water wars. What is ahead for this country when it comes to protecting, sharing, and managing water? And up here to talk about that, again, a great panel. Steve Fleischley with the National, he's the National Water Program Director with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Rena Stryker, founder of Watershed Sustainability. She's here from Atlanta, board chair of the Southeast Watershed Forum. And Paul Davis, right here, is pinch hitting for someone, Jared Bales with the U.S. Geological Survey. He was going to be here, but because of the shutdown, he's not. Paul Davis is here, and we are grateful. Director of Water Pollution Control with the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation. And so I want to have a kind of a conversation at first, and then, of course, open it up for questions. And I want to start with Paul. In your role as Director of Water Pollution Control for the state of Tennessee for many years, how have you seen the water wars develop, and what do you see happening in the future as the population continues to grow?
Well, thanks, Ben. I'd like to start off by thanking the group for the invitation to be here and for what environmental journalists are doing to improve environmental literacy, which in my judgment is sorely, sorely needed in this country. And Ben, I think the answer is in the absence of whole resource planning, whole watershed planning, what you're left with is the states are the owners of water, and they have shared resources, and the states are strongly self-motivated, and so the motivation is when we don't have whole watershed plans to get in and get it first and make it mine and maximize my benefit from it at the expense of anybody else. And so we've seen in the Southeast, we've seen it, the ACF, Alabama, Georgia, Florida situation. We've had water wars to some extent in Tennessee, the groundwater issue, the Memphis aquifer, the competition for the Arkansas irrigation versus Memphis urban use versus Mississippi. You know, who's drawing down the groundwater table there. You know, there's discussion about Atlanta, access to Tennessee river.
Do you think it's possible then for states to work together?
It's possible for them to work together, but to do that, Ben, they've got to concede some authority. And in my experience, states don't like to do it. I've gone on more than one occasion representing the state of Tennessee to meetings that are organized by the Corps of Engineers and with the aspiration that there would be basin-wide planning. And some of the discussion is cordial, but at the end of it, when the Corps says, all right, who's in? Who's ready to be part of a planning process that has to which each state makes a commitment, and the results of which each state agrees to live with, you don't see it happening.
Because there's no motivation. What is the motivation of a governor from Tennessee to work with the governor of Georgia to solve another state's water problem?
Well, right. And it's politically unpopular to say we're going to do something for anybody else. And you see it in the... Well, in the newspapers. I mean, you see it in what's being said by the legislators in the two states. You know, there are people in the Tennessee General Assembly that say we're going to post the state police at the border, and we're going to, you know, to the last drop of blood, we're going to defend against that intrusion. Now, these people don't have any expertise about whether the water could be safely removed or under what circumstance. But it's a strongly held position.
So I want to ask Rena then, can communities stick to their own watersheds for water? I mean, what do you think going forward, again, as populations grow, mm-hmm. Can communities do that? Is it physically possible?
Maybe some can, but many can't. And I don't think you can be a purist about it. Where I'm from in Atlanta, it's one of the smallest watersheds in the United States for the largest population. And we're doing it, but we are affecting others. So the water that we're getting from Lake Lanier is also needed downstream for the farmers of Southwest Georgia. It's also needed for the oysters in Apalachicola Bay of Florida. We've got interbasin transfers already going on. I don't know how that would stop, but there should be more thought about when and if and how it should be done. I think that the water wars has been a little bit helpful in Georgia as far as folks conserving, because we can't argue that we should have water if we're not already conserving. So where you've got land use practices in the cities, paving over green infrastructure, work can be done to save water, and rainwater harvesting has become a bigger piece of Atlanta's game plan. In the Southwest, the farmers are using more precision irrigation than before, so to save the groundwater. And these practices can be repeated throughout the Southeast and around the world. And it's kind of a D.C. versus the, you know, people actually out there on the ground, or even in corporate. There's corporate versus field offices. The folks on the ground aren't really fighting. The farmer across the line from Florida, same river, just changes names when you cross border from Flint to Apalachicola. They're working hard to be more efficient with their water, to save the water for future use, and then for the Flint River itself in Georgia and the oysters in the bay. So I think there's some positives.
Is the big threat the quantity that we're going to run out of water, or is it the quality that we are going to pollute it to the extent that it's not usable? What is the bigger threat?
It depends on where you are. Water quantity is a big issue. For example, in the Ogallala Aquifer out west, it's not replenishing like the Floridan Aquifer in Georgia. A lot faster. It could be 1,500 years in that aquifer, so you're really mining dinosaur water. In the southeast, in these, you know, sustainable cities, what y'all been talking about the past couple days, water quality is an issue. So the development, the land use that's happening that decreases the ability for rainwater to soak into the ground and become clean and go as groundwater to replenish the streams is being wasted, such that we don't have enough water during drought, but we've got too much water during flooding because of the pavement. So that's water quality and quantity at the same time. With the farmers, it can be water quality and quantity at the same time. Runoff from farms, for example, in the breadbasket, too much fertilizer that is wasted going downstream and causing the Gulf Coast hypoxic zone, the dead zone around Louisiana and the Gulf, but also the practices that can help save water quality can also help with infiltration. Besides just conservation irrigation, direct seeding or no-till, we call it, instead of plowing the land, putting the seeds directly into the soil where you've got that thatch left over from years before of vegetation that builds the soils and makes the plants have deeper roots because there have already been plants down there, and helps you be able to grow more crop per drop. Doing more with less, like you say, more population. How are we going to do it? We're hoping that we can still do it on the same amount of land. And that's where I think corporations can come in and say, hey, when we're sourcing our ingredients, we have our own guiding principles. And one of them is we're not going to buy any ingredients from land that's been recently converted from natural areas. And I think that's a profound way that nonprofit, private folks can come in, for-profit private folks can come in when the federal government isn't as strong as it should be. Or,
yeah. Right, about the federal government being as strong as it needs to be. I mean, what you all do, you put together some interesting reports, and that's kind of what I want to do, is give people the tools they need to do a story immediately. And some of the reports you've done really kind of highlight some problems. But what would you say some problems are when it comes to water quality issues and what sort of reports have you done? Kind of talk about that broad topic.
Sure. And there's sort of the national issues, and then there's the federal issues, if you will. From a national perspective, I think we've seen that in some communities, it's a curse of too little water and drought. You know, certainly last year was significant drought across the United States. In other communities, it's a curse of too much water with flooding, even along the Mississippi, as we've seen in Colorado recently. And then in some communities, it's a curse of both, too much and too little water, where more extreme precipitation events might lead to flooding, and yet the period of time between those extreme precipitation events are drier than normal. So you might have drought in between. You also might see communities suffering from sea level rise and the intensities of storms and flooding associated with that. In terms of what we've been doing, we did a report a couple years ago now with Tetra Tech and looked at a water sustainability index across the United States, and we found that over a third of the counties in the lower 48 states will be at extreme or high risk of water sustainability problems by the year 2050. They will not be able to replenish their water resources at the same rate that they've been using them. Some of the issues that maybe people aren't aware of is how this manifests itself. The two largest users of water, the number one from a withdrawal standpoint is power plants for cooling water. 41% of all fresh surface water in the United States is used for power plant cooling. On the consumption side, on the power plant side, that water is circulated and then discharged back into a waterway. On the consumption side, it's agriculture. And so where we have drought, agriculture's obviously at risk. And as Rena's mentioned, you know, we have tensions between farmers and fishermen, you know, on the ACF, for example, but also on California and the San Joaquin and elsewhere. We have tensions between upstream users and downstream users. We have tensions between power plants that need to operate and need to use a lot of that water and other users. Power plants are incredibly vulnerable because of lower water flow in waterways, particularly if they use once through cooling. Enormous quantities of water are used to cool power plants. And if the local in-stream flow is down, they may have to curtail their power operations because there's just not enough water there to cool their facilities. Also, if water temperatures are too hot, they may have to curtail their operations. So those are sort of on the threat side. But on the what are people doing about it side, we did a report last year called Ready or Not, and you can find it on our website. If you just Google NRDC Ready or Not, we looked at all 50 states, and we looked at not only what are their vulnerabilities by state, are they preparing for the water-related impacts of climate change in particular? Mm-hmm. And we found very few states are. There were about 10 that even have comprehensive plans around climate change and water and its impacts, let alone implementing those plans, just developing the plans. And then the vast majority of states either don't mention climate change or make a passing reference to it, maybe in the water stress that they'll be facing. And in that report, if people want to go on there, every state is very well documented. Literally, there are 3,000 footnotes in the report because if we want to make sure that people are comfortable with the science that we're citing on that. And so every state on the vulnerability side, every fact, we give a citation, you know, for an academic peer-reviewed report or a government agency report that supports that. And on the preparedness side, you know, people can link to the actual state plans around water, whether it's in a water plan, whether it's in a wildlife plan, but sort of are they thinking in an integrated way about how to prepare for these threats?
What is the greatest threat? Would it be a drought? Would it be floods?
You know, like Rena said, it really depends where you live. I think 90% of states are poised for more frequent intense storm events, you know, rain, heavy rain events, based on the scientific literature out there. Certainly in the West, water supply is going to be a problem, but that's not just restricted to the West. And so if you go on our map, you can click on the state, and it'll actually list whether it's water supply challenges, whether it's intense storm intensity, whether it's sea level rise, whether it's aquatic impacts, mm-hmm. Impacts to fisheries, those sorts of things.
And as a regulator, a former regulator, where do you think we are right now with regulation on clean water Is there enough? Is it diminishing? Is it 2 weeks? Where do you think we stand?
Well, I mean, it's uneven. Then the Clean Water Act has wonderful aspirations. We're going to achieve, no toxics. We're going to achieve fishable, swimmable. But in Title IV, you don't have the teeth to achieve those aspirations. You exempt the major source of impact in this country is exempt from most pollution control law. And so that puts us in a position of enticing or educating or using public money to pay for those sources to manage water in a way that keeps the resource clean. And I'm talking, of course, about agriculture. Even from a quantity standpoint, Dodd mentioned earlier the efforts that the state of Tennessee has made to protect waters, and the Interbasin Transfer Statute is a good statute, but there's no quantity regulation in Tennessee goes to agriculture. And so if you're going to irrigate your golf course or your yard, or if you're going to drink the water yourself, there are statutes that require you to protect the water so that it remains fishable. But for an ag user, those statutes don't apply. A producer can totally dewater a stream as it passes, if he's a riparian user. And so your question is, what's the where are we in terms of regulation to reach social goals for waters? And my answer is we're unevenly distributed.
What are you saying, Rena, with watersheds and agriculture specifically?
Sure. There are good regulations, strong and helpful with point source, of course. But the non-point source, which is what we were talking about before, the water flowing off degraded properties or paved over properties is a huge pollutant. So there's really, not that I know of, but you're the lawyer, so you can tell me, strong laws federally for non-point source pollution with agriculture. There are with livestock, confined animal feeding operations, but not much on the way of regular row crop systems. The states do have laws. Some have great programs, safe harbor type of programs, where if you're doing these best management practices, then you won't come under any penalties. Some areas, I think a federal judge just upheld EPA's stance with Chesapeake Bay that the agricultural community needs to do something to help with that pollution there. EPA has said if we can reduce nitrates coming off of farms in the Corn Belt by 45%, then that will significantly decrease the Gulf Coast hypoxic zone. Yet there's no law that says every farmer needs to reduce. You better reduce or you're not going to be able to farm anymore. So I think that, like you said, there's encouragement. Sometimes there's payment for environmental services through the Farm Bill. Company I consult for, Coca-Cola, has even done some payment for environmental services with farmers in Michigan to conduct the no-tillage so that they are increasing groundwater recharge to help sustain the watershed that's the source water for the local Minute Maid plant there. So I think that hopefully that we can do more payment for environmental services to farmers that can help them make the buck they need, grow more crop per drop, build their soils, grow the same amount on the same amount or more on the same land, because we need it. But we also don't need Gulf Coast hypoxia or extinguished aquifers.
See, we have a Democratic administration, a Democratic president. Have you seen a change as far as environmental regulation? Are you comfortable with where we are? Are you not comfortable? What would you say?
You know, it's a good question. I think in some areas, particularly in the air arena, we've seen significant improvement. I hate to say it. I think on the water side of things, we haven't seen a lot of activity for the benefit of the environment. There are a lot of things that the administration could do, and I'm hopeful that they will do before this second term is out. You know, on the federal side, as has been mentioned, the federal government doesn't really regulate water supply issues. It's largely a water quality regulatory scheme, particularly with the Clean Water Act. But there are some things that can really build resilience into our system that these federal laws can work toward. Protection of waters of the United States, particularly wetlands and intermittent streams, which is an issue that's been out there for quite some time. The Supreme Court really muddied the waters, if you will, around jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act back in 2001 and 2006 with their Swank and Rapanos decisions. One was decided 5-4, one was decided 4-1-4. And it really confused the agencies on what waterways are protected. And the notion that, you know, when you look at wetlands in particular and these intermittent streams, and EPA's website has this information, 117 million people in the United States get some of their drinking water supply from waterways that are at risk because of the Supreme Court decisions. And we've been waiting a long, long time to get clarity from the administration around whether wetlands and intermittent streams are protected. They're finally moving forward. They just sent over a draft proposal to the Office of Management and Budget last week or the week before. They've convened a scientific advisory board to try to make sure that the science around protecting these waterways is clear. That's one thing they could be doing. There's also a pending rule out there under 316B of the Clean Water Act, which is power plant cooling water regulations, and the notion that power plants shouldn't be sucking all this water in. It regulates intake and requires the best technology available for intake for power plant cooling. November 4th is when the rule is supposed to come out, and unfortunately, I think they're going to end up punting to the states on this issue, where they could use it as an opportunity to restrict power plants from how much water they suck in and encourage them to do things like use reclaimed water from sewage treatment plants, which about 67 power plants in the United States use reclaimed water. So they could do that. We're also working on the more innovative side on the crop issues. There's a provision with USDA where you can petition, as long as you have a crop insurance partner, you can petition for a pilot project that we're working on. We just wrote a report called Clean Water. I forgot what the heck we called it. Anyways, it's a crop report from NRDC. Just came out like a month ago.
Great.
And the notion would be to work with farmers who do no-till, who use cover crops and use responsible irrigation practices, to try to get an insurance premium reduction for crop insurance.
That's great.
Sort of an incentive for them to do the right thing, but you have to have a crop insurance partner, and so we're trying to do that outside the regulatory context and more in the financing side of things. But there's a lot more this administration could be doing. Stormwater regulation, stormwater protections. We've been waiting on a rule. The National Stormwater Rule has been talked about for a long, long time about coming out. And CBF, Chesapeake Bay Foundation, sued on this a while ago. EPA has been granted 7 extensions under the settlement agreement to try to get this rule to come out. We're hopeful something will come out in the spring, but it's very slow going, and we're disappointed to see it. And, you know, I think it's important because EPA has been getting so much flack, if you will, from some of the more extreme folks in Congress that take up a lot of their time. They have to respond to a lot of questions about what they're doing, a lot of false accusations about regulating crop dust and having drones to patrol farmers. And they released some information on factory farms recently to us under a Public Records Act request that caused a big hoopla. You know, the public trying to understand where factory farms are located and what waterways are impaired because of them. You know, so they're having to be on defense quite a bit. And, you know, there's probably some political calculations in there as well. They want to move forward on other issues, and water just hasn't been a priority, unfortunately.
I've got a question for you. we hear about factory farms and industrial farming, but I've never met an industrialist of, you know, Mr. Burns from The Simpsons that's a farmer. I mean, families. And commercial farming can be a family farm, but you're making money off of it. I'm a commercial person. I'm in business, a one-person business called Watershed Sustainability, but I'm not a mean captain of industry. So I'd like to hear from you, what's a factory farm?
Yeah.
You know, are they real?
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear your opinion on the difference between that and family farms.
Sure. Yes, they are real. Let me first preface it with, I grew up in Nebraska, and I detasseled corn in the summer on family farms. Not my family, but other families' farms. Factory farms, the way I would define it, is the legal definition of a concentrated animal feeding operation in particular. I don't think of row cropping as a factory farm from my perspective, so if I implied that, I apologize. You know, there are corporate farms. They're often operated by folks who are families and live on those farms. But corporate factory animal farms, where they confine large numbers of animals, whether it's hogs, whether it's chickens, you know, if you could go visit these things, the hog farms in North Carolina, for example, some of these large facilities, I've got some really remarkable pictures, if you'd ever like to see them, of big lagoons with hog waste in them, and then they spray the waste on the fields, and they often do not apply it at agronomic rates. It runs into local waterways. It pollutes the waterways with excessive nutrients. On chicken farms, you know, they warehouse a lot of these animals, and then they pile up the chicken litter, and unfortunately sometimes it's outside and it gets rained on and the stuff runs right off into the local waterways. So that's what I'm talking about.
Well, I want to, in a moment, open it up for questions, but we have group of journalists here, and I want to ask each of you, when it comes to flooding, droughts, water wars, what do you think are the most underreported issues or the most underreported issue, and how would you recommend that somebody go about covering it? When it comes to that broad topic, what would you love to see covered more, and how would you recommend that it be tackled? I'll start.
Okay, good. Well, Ben, I mean, it's a wonderful question. I mean, what you see reported is things that make a visual impact within seconds. If you're a television person or an NPR listener, things that will make an impact within the first 3 to 5 seconds. And if it doesn't, it's harder to get a grasp on. And things like that I mentioned, like whole watershed planning, flood risk management, drought risk management, all of those are the technology is not beyond us to reduce risk from flooding. The technology is not beyond us to reduce drought risk. But there's a cost associated with it. And what I've seen over my career, long time, is that planning, water monitoring are things that just get cut because you have, consider you've got decision horizons that are 2 or 4 years. You've got mayors that are elected on 2-year terms or 4-year terms, and it says, well, you know, I'm not going to raise your rates, and I'm going to hold on like crazy to get by with the amount of infrastructure that we have, or the type of infrastructure that we have, or the monitoring base that we have for those 2 or 4 years, and the result will be that I won't be raising your rates. And if my successor does, I'll run against that. And the same at the state basis. You know, say, you know what, it would be great if we had a planning exercise. Okay, great, go in that room and plan. Well, we need some data, and we're going to need some help, and we're going to need some. There's going to be some expense associated with it. Well, now that's a whole different That's a different level of commitment. And so, you know, in Tennessee, following the May 2010 flood, the city of Nashville was able to make some stuff happen. In April of 2010, the city could have said, you know what, we're going to put together a warning system. We're going to go down the riverfront, and we're going to put up some structure that we can lower gates in if we hear it's going to start raining. We're going to put in these gates, and that will protect downtown Nashville. And here's the cost. And the citizenry would have said, wait a minute, that sounds to us like cost.
It's reality.
And so what the media can do is just go back to my environmental literacy term, and thinking about environment in the large sense, go back to the environmental literacy an analogy, because from a policy implementer, from a law enforcer standpoint, you know, you can just do what the public will stand for, and so the public needs to be moved. And environmental advocacy, I'm now working with advocacy groups. Advocacy needs to educate folks, and to the extent that journalism can do that, that would be great too. And in order for journalism to do it, of course, they've got to tell an interesting enough story to hang on to the reader. And if they want to tell more than one story, they need to have some integrity to what they're saying. And often without finding a really bad guy and a really good guy, those it's just not that simple. And so it's a tough job to report the heaviest of those issues in a way that will grab attention.
What do you think? That is good.
Yeah, I mean, a bear attack is pretty exciting. You can weave some nature conservation into that, but what is exciting about stormwater? Yeah. But there are some visual images that you could show. I've got a slide of a culvert, and you think it's just any culvert, but then once I show the arrow, it's pointing to a little guy that's this big, and the message there is billions and billions of liters of stormwater are treated like waste that we could have saved for drought or used to decrease flooding if it was managed better. Another one piece with stormwater is if you put all the lawns together, that's quite a landmass and ecosystem itself that can provide ecosystem services of soaking water into the land. So there are things to think about, even urban-wise, that aren't quite as exciting as the buffalo roaming and a hot conservation cowboy, but the stormwater story still should be told. And I think perhaps it could be with towns is taking ownership of what is their watershed, and then where is the source water of that, and the whole idea behind Manhattan and the Catskills and protecting those instead of having to develop another water treatment plant is a wonderful way to present it. Love a conservation cowboy. I think that's a good story. The family farmer being able to pass down your farm from generation to generation and keep that iconic American figure going. And a lot of NGOs, conservation NGOs, are behind that because there's no reclamation plan for a strip mall. But land can be restored that was farmed or overgrazed. It can come back, and nature can forgive. And we keep saying that we're destroying nature. We're destroying ourselves. Nature bats last. We'll be gone, and nature will still be going. So it's up to us what we're trying to save. And I think bringing it back to the human story is a way to go.
And Steve, what do you think? Flooding, droughts, water wars. What's the most underreported thing, or something that is underreported, and what tool would you recommend be used to report it?
Well, I agree with what the other speakers have said. I think you've got to make these issues real for people where they live. You know, they need to see the relevance to them. The things like Hurricane Sandy and the Colorado floods, those are horrific events. But if people don't have an appreciation for the vulnerabilities that they face in their own communities, whether it's on water supply, whether it's on agriculture or other issues, they're not going to appreciate the interconnectedness of all of these issues. And so I think talking about what the vulnerabilities are at a local level, talking about what the costs of inaction are. Oftentimes it's talked about what the cost of taking action is. But oftentimes the reactive notion of how much we spend responding to these problems as opposed to putting money up front. I think FEMA has estimated that a dollar invested up front creates four times the savings on the other side of things. And so instead of, and maybe it's human nature to be reactive and resilient in that way, but really laying out for people, look, by investing now in this and there are solutions, we can avoid these other things. And maybe these other things seem somewhat speculative. The Texas Water Plan, I remember, calls climate change a speculative risk and lumped it in with terrorism and natural disasters in those categories. And yet terrorism and natural disasters are things we plan for. We prepare ourselves and try to prevent the worst impacts from those, you know, whether it's an earthquake or whether it's a terrorist attack. It's not like we just sit around and wait for those things to happen to us. That's not the kind of society we are. And yet, when we talk about the speculative risks of what climate change and drought and flooding and these other things are at a local level, for some reason, there are some folks who don't appreciate the importance of addressing them head on from the get-go. So I think that's where how to do it. The tools, I don't know about whether the conservation cowboy is better than, you know, anything else. I really think it, you know, going out and talking to people in your communities and showing them real world examples of where this has worked. You know, we talk about landscape irrigation. Las Vegas has spent $300 million paying people to rip out their lawns, which I think is awesome. Because they're building resilience into the system, as opposed to telling people once they have their lawns, well, now you got to stop watering, and people are going to be resistant to that sort of thing. You know, they don't want to look bad, they don't want to have an ugly yard. But if they see that other communities have done it, done drought tolerant landscaping and that sort of thing, and green infrastructure can be quite beautiful, and it provides multiple benefits, not just the water quality side of things, the water supply side of things, the open space, clean air, you know, better recreational opportunities for people. If people, I think, can see those benefits, they'll appreciate the need to take advantage of them.
Okay. All right, I want to open it up. Yes. State your name and speak clearly.
My name is Stuart Moore. I'm a freelance journalist based out of Nashville, Tennessee. I don't believe we pay the true cost of water. How would you go about calculating the true cost of water? What would that do to the cost of water? And where would that money go once it went into the hands of your local utility to mitigate mm-hmm. not paying the true cost of water and what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense.
So who wants to take that?
Well, I'll start. Water and...
Can you just kind of rephrase that question?
Which... Oh, okay. Uh-huh. I'm Paul Davis again, and that was Stuart Moore's question. And his question was going back to this business of value versus pricing. And it's a subject that it's getting a lot of attention. Water Environment Federation has a campaign now titled "Water's Worth It," and the thought there is that folks are so used to water bills, both water supply and wastewater, that are in the low double digits all across the country, that when we talk about making infrastructure improvements, like improving wastewater systems, which will have the effect of improving public health, reduce sewer overflows, some places reduce combined sewers. Well, some of those improvements are available to us, but they're available at a cost, and that cost might be more than the CPI adjustment on, you know, for that year's bill. It might be more than 1.5 or 2.5 or 3.5% increase on the water bill. And so the way to get back through that is folks like everybody in this room helping to educate the public on, you know, we're really, if your sewer bill is $20 and having it be $40 instead would have the effect in 5 years of reducing bacteria in urban waters, then, you know, most people would say that's worth it, but it's 100% increase in cost. And what you see, I mean, you'll pick up the paper, unless Ann wrote it. Ann, of course, would have written it differently, but sometimes the paper would say Metro looking for 100% rate increase. Well, I'm not going to be able to flush any more wastewater down the toilet even after I pay that 100%. So what's the benefit? What's the benefit to me? So I think what your question gets to is how do we articulate to folks what the benefit is of that protection of public health or the having a higher confidence that we're drinking safe water on the front end or drought resistance. You know, we can add storage. That has the result of making us more resistant to a drought. It comes at a cost. And that's education.
Do one of y'all want to take that?
Right. I don't know back of the envelope statistic of here's where, you know, it should cost 200 times more or whatever. But I know that American Rivers put together a paper called Hidden Reservoir, and it looks at that. So I'd recommend that to you. And with industry, I know with Coca-Cola, they work really hard to be more efficient in their plants with the water use, try to have a water use ratio where it doesn't take 3 cans of water to make a can of Coke, but get closer towards 1 can per can. But some of the bottlers will say, well, we're doing this, but then the factory next door is wasting tons of water. So how do I know if I'm conserving water, it's not just getting wasted somewhere else? And there's something that I believe it's coming out of the University of Arizona called Conserve to Enhance, where if you can get your municipality to adopt it, that folks who reduce their water use still pay the same as what they did before, but the amount of that savings goes to a fund that would pay for protection, conservation of the recharge area that's supplying that source water supply. So there's ways that you could go about it. I don't know that anyone's done it yet, but that would be something great to see.
I would just add one thing, Stuart, and that's tiered water pricing has become much more popular. You know, the notion that our water bills are less than our cable bill and less than our phone bill is pretty surprising, unless you have like a large swimming pool or a really, really large lawn that you're watering. You know, that's typically the case. And tiered water pricing would be, you know, there's sort of a basic indoor human use that you need, you know, whether it's for showers and sinks and stuff like that, that you would set the lowest price level at, and then you would tier up from there, and then, you know, 3 or 4 tiers up, you know, it would be much more expensive per unit of water used. You know, so if you want to water your lawn in the desert, you're going to pay for that. Where does that money then go, though? I think that's the challenge. And, you know, is it going to go into a fund to make sure that there's adequate flow in a waterway for ecosystem services, for fish and those sorts of things? Or is it going to go to build, you know, new infrastructure, new gray infrastructure? And I think that's something folks still struggle with. Or is it going to go to a conservation fund to pay people to remove their lawns and encourage other conserving practices? But you're seeing that more. Volumetric wastewater pricing is another mechanism that folks are using more, which is to link your wastewater bill to how much water you bring in. So, for example, you know, what goes down your pipes might not be directly related to how much water you're consuming. Again, the landscape irrigation side of things, that doesn't register when you flush the toilet because it's all outside. But if you made wastewater pricing based on how much water you're bringing in as opposed to purely how much you're discharging into the system, that's another way to sort of capture some of that value of water or the price of water.
Hi, I'm Brian Calvert. I'm a Ted Scripps Fellow at the University of Colorado in Boulder. This is kind of a policy question. So we just had this fantastic flooding event and storm event in Boulder. And we also see in the IPCC report that there are going to be more extreme weather events, and we know that the hydrological cycle is affected by a warming planet. And yet you can't really take one storm and attach it to that sort of science yet. There's too many variables in the model. And my question is, like, what kind of challenge that presents when you're trying to make a risk assessment? And you're trying to build that into policy. For example, the community of Boulder is going to have to now look at their risk assessments for flood, and they're going to have to take some of this information into account, and yet they can't quite. You know, do you see changes coming on the risk assessment side of policy, vis-a-vis these sort of like increased storm events, even if we can't quite link them together definitively, scientifically, to climate change?
Okay, well, thank you. On the subject of risk, I'll try to restate your question. Brian Calvert, and the question goes to policy changes in flood risk management that will likely follow a cataclysmic event like the one in Colorado, or in my experience, the one in Nashville, May 2010. And you know, my thought on that is that flood risks are manageable. And they're not preventable, but they're manageable. You can narrow risk several ways. You can just move away from the water. And what we've done over time is you see it, you know, it's the problem you see every time we have hurricane reports. We've moved to the coast. We're on the coast. We're flat on the water. People want to be right on the water. They want to be right on the river. And so land use planning is a way to do it. And following a flood event, those properties are injured. And so the question becomes, do we let folks build back there? And if we do let them build back there, to what extent does the society at large assume the risk? And to what extent do we say, tell you what, you can build back there, buy your own insurance, we're not helping you next time? And you know, where on that continuum does your value set put you? So land use planning I expect to see that discussed in Colorado. And it was discussed in Nashville. Metro went in and bought some property and said, you're not rebuilding there. We are going to pay you the value of that property on May 9th of 2010. The flood was the 10th. We're going to pay you what it was worth the day before the flood. We're not going to pay you any more than that, but you're not going to build back there. And the result is we won't have this damage again if we have another 1,000-year-plus recurrence interval flood, which is what we had then. And that's one way to deal with risk. You can manage risk up in the watershed. I really don't know Colorado. I know in Colorado you can't even build rain barrels.
Right.
You can't even attach rain barrels in Colorado because you're taking somebody's water away. So retaining and detaining water in Colorado is a whole different issue than it is in Tennessee, but you can do dry dams. I mean, there's technical ways to do it. There are land management ways to minimize risk. You can build structures up higher, set them on stilts. All of that comes at cost, and the good news is there are models, there are technical folks that can look at, for any watershed, we want to reduce risk from this level to this level. What's the most cost effective way to get there? And whose cooperation, whose buy-in do we have to have in order to make that happen?
Yeah,
Just to follow up, really what I'd like to know is how that discussion is changing now, given some of the climate change information that we have in terms of likely increase in these types of events.
Well, climate change adaptation, and there are whole conferences on climate change adaptation. And in Tennessee, when we did our regional water planning, you know, we were aware, certainly we wanted to factor climate change in. And so we went to two or three groups and said, okay, here are the watersheds we're going to be doing. Tell us how climate change is going to affect the way we get the waterfalls and runs off. And you don't get high, you know, in inland, you don't get real high confidence. You know, folks say, well, I think this might happen or this might happen. And so what we wind up doing was just build in a factor of safety into our water plans.
Well, and to follow up, you did this preparedness report, mm-hmm. and RDC did. You said there were seven states that indicated they were highly prepared or on an upper level of preparedness. Were those states, do you think they had recently some sort of disaster? Is there any sort of correlation between something like what we've just seen and their willingness to prepare? Or what about that?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that when we did it, but thinking about the states, and I think there were actually 10 in terms of planning, I don't think there was a correlation. But, you know, I don't know if you saw this morning's Washington Post, Mayor Bloomberg and others were calling on a national risk assessment on the financial side. I think on your question, you know, the notion, and there are a lot of studies that say this, whether or not the states have incorporated them into their plans or not, on the frequency of flooding events in particular, you know, if a 100-year event is really going to happen every 10 years in the future, mm-hmm. whatever you want to attribute that to, there are planning tools to use around that. I think floodplain mapping is going to become an even more important issue. You know, people who own, you know, people who live in the floodplain and think they own their own home really are only renting from Mother Nature. That's the reality. And maybe we're going to pay for it once. But, you know, these multiple buyouts or these multiple paybacks don't make a lot of sense. I think you're seeing more willingness on the buyout side, certainly after Hurricane Sandy, and the Governor Cuomo just announced yesterday a new effort for buyouts for 600 more homes that they're looking at, you know, again, to create these storm buffers, get people out of harm's way. Whereas a few years ago, if you talked about planned retreat, people were like, we don't retreat, you know, and it's like, okay, well, if it's a buyout program, maybe that's a different conversation. In Cedar Rapids, we saw that happen after flooding there, where people were more inclined to say, yeah, being in the floodplain, while it may be nice and the properties are cheaper, in the short term, in the long term, this might not be in my family's best interest, and maybe we should allow nature rain in those areas. So I think you're seeing it more in the science, how it reflects in the federal policies, you know, with the price of flood insurance and things like that. You know, once it starts to get really expensive and the federal government, you know, can't afford it, to tell people who already live in the floodplain, well, we're going to step out and now you have to, you know, go through private insurance to pay for that, you know, they're really not going to be able to afford it. But I think the real trick is when these events happen, you know, make sure that we're not. This was a while ago on TV, a church that had been washed out like seven or eight times, and they kept rebuilding in the same place. You know, and I was just like, and the federal government was paying for it, and it was like, how is this possible? You know, whether it's a homeowner, whether it's a business, we shouldn't be doing that. It just doesn't make any fiscal sense. So, anyway, that's my thought on it.
I want to also just repeat everybody's titles. Steve is National Water Program Director with the Natural Resources Defense Council. Rena Ann Stryker, founder of Watershed Sustainability, also a consultant for Coca-Cola, board chair, Southeast Watershed Forum. And Paul Davis is the former director of the Division of Water and Pollution for the state of Tennessee, the former director. So what other questions? go ahead. Then we'll
the
go.
The Atlanta Regional Commission said this week that there had been a 15% decrease over the past decade in total water use for the 15 counties around the Atlanta area. Do you trust that kind of an argument? And if so, do you think that it might mean that the reported water crisis has been overly exaggerated by media?
And what's your name?
Bruce Ritchie with the Florida Current in Tallahassee.
Bruce Ritchie, Florida Current in Tallahassee. 15% decrease in water usage is reported in Atlanta area. Do you trust that?
I'll start. This is Paul Davis again. Bruce Ritchie was the question. And if they reported it, I suspect that it's true. I mean, here's what Atlanta's stormwater program, very progressive compared to other cities, and what you've just come out of is a time when growth slowed down because of the economy, and improvements were made in water conservation. But that's not a trajectory that Atlanta can stay on. If they reported it, I have no reason to think that it wouldn't be true, and it's plausible for me to think that it may be true, because you had a slowdown in growth, and you had some policies in place that tightened up plumbing codes, conservation, just the things that I know that Atlanta is doing. They have a boatload of people working on smart management, but If they don't get a handle on population reliant on that water base, it can't stay. I mean, you can put a damper on it for a short time, but the curve is going to go back up, because at some point you're going to get all the conservation benefits that you can get from the present plumbing codes and conservation measures that they've put in place.
Rena, what do you think about that?
I think that there has been water savings, and it behooves Atlanta to save water so Atlanta can stick up for itself in Georgia, you know, in the water wars. If we're not doing anything, then we're not going to get any benefit of the doubt in Georgia. So I do think there is still a water crisis. Water is a renewable natural resource, but that doesn't mean it's not limited. I think maybe more limited is our thought around it and policy around it. So it's got to be tied to land use planning, and it's largely not. We were talking earlier about we're not doing watershed-based planning because we've got counties and jurisdictions and state lines and such, and that it's rare if any regional group comes through. I think Upper Neuse has a regional watershed planning group. There's still a water crisis, but there's water crises all around the world. Our water war is nothing compared to Israel and Palestine's water war, where they're keeping the water from Palestine. So I think we've got a good way to go. I think, at one point the governors thought they could just go out to dinner and figure it out. It's bigger than that. And we've got to be able to say what's needed in stream, what is the water budget, what all do we all need, and do the science and get her done.
Okay. We'll go there and then there.
Sure. Gloria Gonzalez with Ecosystem Marketplace. I just wanted to follow up on what Steve was talking about with regard to the flood insurance program. I'm a native New York City girl, and I've lived in New York and San Sandy. And a lot of the local news coverage revolved around the fact that people just, despite the devastation of Sandy, their homes being wrecked, they wanted to build on the coast. So there still is that element of people, even though they have experienced the effects of climate change and this horrific storm, they still don't want to move. And so now they're encouraging basically the legislation to push back against the revamp of the flood insurance program that Congress had implemented to put that program on work for sound financial aid. So I guess my question is, how do you sort of reconcile that, the fact that even though people are still actually experiencing these dangers firsthand, there's still that element of, well, these are our homes, we don't want to move, even though we understand that, there's significant risk presented for these water-related natural disasters.
And Steve, why don't you take that? That's Gloria Gonzalez, Ecosystem
marketplace.
Yeah, and Gloria's comment related to sort of the tension between people's desire to stay in their coastal communities versus the real threat of recurring events that might displace them. You know, from my perspective, I totally understand why people want to live in those places. They're beautiful places. You know, the coast is an amazing place, and you know, a larger and larger percentage of the population lives adjacent to the coast. I think the question is really one of whether the federal and state governments should be subsidizing that activity versus what people's right is to choose where they want to live. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think in general, and unless, you know, the government's going to utilize eminent domain, you know, people have every right to be there. But whether particularly, you know, with the flood insurance program and the financial straits that it's in, should we be subsidizing that activity? And again, I would say, yeah, maybe once we should do it, but after that, it's you're sort of on your own. You know what the risks are. I read one person was saying, yeah, 362 days a year, it's awesome, and 2 days, it's bad, and those are the 2 days where your house gets washed away. So you're going to have to make that own cost-benefit assessment for yourself and your family, but I don't see why others should subsidize that risky behavior, if you will.
Indeed. I mean, and just to follow up, that's something that I would agree with, except that they put pressure on their legislators to go back to
sure.
So then it becomes a political issue because you have some legislators who want to please their constituents and will push to move back the program back to the way it was so that it allows them to continue to live there.
Can I take a piggyback on your comment? Like, because we went to the flood of 2011 and Congress backpedaled on the flood insurance program under pressure from constituents.
Yeah. What? I mean, and that's their First Amendment right, and, you know, people are going to do that, and I think, you know, as we see with Congress, Congress has a hard time getting things done these days. You know, the public, I think it's incumbent on the rest of us who pay those bills to say, look, there are some things that we think the federal government should be spending money on, and there are some things that we don't think. And so, yes, those people will be vocal, but by the same measure, you know, there are a lot of folks who are vocal on the other side, and I think those folks just need to continue to be vocal. I mean, that's sort of how the system works. And if other folks don't speak out about not wanting to spend money on those issues, then the local homeowners are going to keep getting subsidized. It's just the way it works.
Yeah. Okay, I'll say right there next. Okay. No, you right there. Yeah.
My name is Nina Sativa, and I'm with the ISIS Tribune. And I had a question about availability of good data on a lot of this, especially on water availability and water use. And it kind of has a lot of question. A lot of people in Texas, and lawyers and such, have told me that, you know, they feel like a lot of water use is self-reported, and this is the numbers that what they'll do is they compare the wholesaler number to the water use number, and it sometimes doesn't match up. So it's hard for us to know even how much water is being used, if those gallons per capita per day numbers are fair and accurate. The aquifer levels is another concern. You know, how much groundwater is actually available and what's going to happen, obviously, climate change continues to play out. And so I was just wondering, especially, you know, from the perspective of a former regulator, you know, probably looked at a lot of these numbers, what do you think needs to be done to improve them, and what are some of the biggest challenges in getting data on water use?
Okay, I'm going to try to repeat that one. And that question is water use data, the extent to which the government really knows how water is being used, I think surface water and groundwater were part of your question. And I can answer it best for my state and for the Southeast. I know a little bit about Texas, but more about Tennessee. And in Tennessee, certain categories of users report use. And I suspect that those categories who do report use do so accurately. I mean, you know, water can only be measured so accurate. Metering is only so accurate. But I suspect that they report that as truthfully as they can. There are categories of use that don't require that don't report, and ag is one of them. Now, we don't have agricultural use. Steve talked about ag use that's potentially in conflict with power plants, and we don't have ag use at that scale, but we do have ag use in smaller streams, wadeable streams or headwaters. And in those cases, you've got a flexible pipe that's put in, you've got a gasoline-driven pump. None of those users report. Agriculture is explicitly exempt from so much as reporting the use that they have. And in Tennessee, particularly in West Tennessee, center pivot irrigation is becoming more in use. We're changing over to the type of crops that would go on that would do well with center pivot irrigation. So we're irrigating more than we did before. And so the answer is the government only knows what the law requires people to tell them. And the law explicitly excludes some sources. Now, the major amount of water that is, quote, used is, as Steve said, power plants. But the resource what the resource sees is a thermal boost, but there's precious little evaporative loss in that, and almost all that water is back. Consumptive use in my state is more important on the headwater and wadeable streams, and consumptive use can be significant. We are regulating, the state of Tennessee regulates municipal water supplies so that they leave a sustainable flow in the stream. The science isn't perfect there. The rules are ahead of the science on that, and so it's possible that we try to be conservative in that, but we regulate municipal water intake so that they're protective and that they leave a natural fluctuation going up and down. And those people are required to measure what they put in. They've got to support maybe a USGS gauging station at their expense, and we have that information. But as I said in an earlier question, it's uneven in terms of what we know.
Next question right here, and then we'll go right there.
All right. I live on another coast, the Great Lakes. We don't have flooding problems that come from the lakes. They come from rivers that feed into them. And we're seeing, as we are elsewhere in the country, storms that sit and pour a heck of a lot of water on the land. We have very flat topography, so the water has nothing to do with spread out, and we're very urban and very overbuilt. And what we're finding is that nobody is regionally working together to deal with flood water issues, except in one area, in about a 5-county area in Cleveland, or center around Cleveland, where there is a sewer district that controls all these areas. What they've done is to tax people, depending on the size of their property, a certain fee, unless they're planning rainbows or using a rainbow or something. Then they get a deduction or a tax break or something. And that water goes into a fund, which then is used to pay for infrastructure solutions to very local flooding issues between, say, two neighboring communities, usually urban ones. And that infrastructure has to be green. It can't be big built projects. They're looking for low impact, low money, big savings to reduce neighborhood flooding. But we're not seeing any other kinds of policy or insurance, even though there are, flood maps and flood zones all over the place.
So it's about regional policies.
Regional policies, or even state policies that are working. And I'm wondering if there are other kinds of policies along the lines of what I was talking about, where you can only start locally, because we've just got this home rule versus state.
Let's ask, what about Steve, what about that? Regional policies, and you're going to Karen?
Karen Schaefer, I'm a freelance reporter out of Northeast Ohio.
Okay.
It's a good question. I've certainly seen it in the stormwater context that you've mentioned with green infrastructure and regional policies around that. You know, and I think we'll see more of it on the Chesapeake with the TMDL there, with the multi-state TMDLs that are coming down or that have been approved and upheld by the courts. I on the flood side, I'm struggling to think of an example. I don't know off the top of my head.
Well, I'm thinking what you, the example that you gave sounds to me like a stormwater fees that are imposed by a regulated stormwater entity in the parlance, MS4, Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System. And a municipality of a certain size is required to have a stormwater program that goes both to quantity and quality. The new rules that Steve mentioned are going to get us away from contaminating stormwater in the first place and taking it to a place to treat it and trying to release clean water to reducing runoff peaks in the first place. And the offsets that you're talking about from fees are where a property owner has a rain garden or has pervious pavement or some other management practice that will have the result of, slow it down, spread it out, soak it in so that we don't have the stormwater volume and the peaks to worry about. And I mean, they have that here in Chattanooga. I mean, every regulated municipal, most regulated stormwater systems in Tennessee charge a fee, and they offset that fee if the property owner has done something to reduce the impervious surface or the peak runoff from that property.
I want to take one more question. Does that answer your question? Are you saying you're not seeing it?
I'm just wondering if there are solutions. I'm also, I guess maybe as a follow-up, do you see this as a trend then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we wrote our report, Clean Water Cash Flows, examined Philadelphia's fee structure and, again, how to motivate private capital to try to incentivize the green infrastructure. Prince George County in Maryland has a very interesting program that they're moving forward with. In Los Angeles, they oddly enough don't have a fee. They've been trying to get one, but 86 cities are all regulated under one permit, and the permit very explicitly talks about what Paul's talking about, is not only do they have to comply with water quality standards, but the preferred approach to get there is what they're calling enhanced watershed management planning, and it's to incentivize stormwater capture for water supply augmentation.
Great.
So you could do the same sort of thing to mitigate flood. The end game is the water quality. The regulatory driver is the water quality piece. But while you're getting there, you may find it's easier, more cost-effective to address these other issues. We like to say it's not wastewater until it's wasted. Why not use it for other things, capture it, retain it on-site, those sorts of things? So, yeah, it's definitely
more. Well, I promise it's right here. And then they'll be available afterwards, too. Last question right here.
It seems like the historically resolved water issues, especially with water scarcity through the court systems, Western states love to sue each other. But as water problems becomes more and more complicated, especially when you're coming out here to the East Coast, are the courts an old system, or is that the end-all game for solving these problems of people sharing a limited resource?
Are the courts the end-all game? And is that even a good place for the game to be ended? I mean, do the courts know enough? But why don't we each take that?
It's good for Georgia and Tennessee. And I think the original game was and remains, I think, these interstate compacts. There's several dozen in the United States, and they're not just on Western waterways, even the Great Lakes Compact. But there's a whole bunch throughout the country where states come to agreement on their own terms with one another on how they're going to regulate the distribution of water. I think the courts should be viewed as a last resort. you know, the fight between Georgia and Tennessee is pretty interesting over the Tennessee River. To me, it sort of just detracts from the larger question of whether there are better ways to be managing water, as opposed to whether one state should take water from another. There was a Texas case recently at the Supreme Court where Texas wanted to go into a neighboring state to exercise their water rights. The Supreme Court rightfully, I think, rejected that approach. But I think states will always resort to the courts where they can't resolve their differences with one another. That's, you know, I think that's always got to be part of the process. It's got to be one of the tools in the toolbox. But I think it should be a tool of last resort.
And Marina, did you want to add to that?
Just that I think partnerships with conservation groups and outdoor industry and ag groups are important for resolving some of these conflicts outside of the courts. So, for example, in Utah, Trout Unlimited worked with local irrigation districts to be able to let the irrigators keep their water even if they weren't using it. So in Arizona, you'll see big palm trees and such green areas that are being watered just so folks can keep their water rights. In Utah, they're able to say, even if you don't use it, that doesn't mean you lose it. And if you want to conserve and allow more water to be in the stream for the fish, you can do that and not lose your water right. Right next door in Wyoming, it's not that way. So when Koch went to invest with these conservation irrigation programs, we could do so in Utah, but not in Wyoming. So Wyoming's losing out, whereas in Utah, the farmers are getting water when and where they need it, and the sportsmen are able to fish.
Here's what I'd say is if a water quality issue is in court, certainly in the eastern U.S., somebody has failed earlier in the process. Somebody's made some mistakes. They failed to plan. And this idea of states suing states, you know, state boundaries aren't real important when you're talking about watersheds. I'll tell you, I mean, I've heard a lot of talk about Georgia and Tennessee. Here's the fact. The fact is the state of Georgia nor the city of Atlanta have ever officially spoken to Tennessee about taking water out of the Tennessee River. It has never happened. Tennessee has a interbasin transfer law. It's a law that sets up the public benefits that are to be considered in making the decision, and the state line is not on that list. They're enumerated from A to Q, and the state line isn't anywhere on that list. Tennessee would play just as nicely. Well, I say it this way. The law would have Tennessee play just as nicely with somebody on the other side of the state border as it would within the state border. The state's not the doesn't prioritize in-state use over out-of-state use. But again, the ticket on this is, you know, the time to. You heard people say the time to make friends is before you need them, and the time to prepare for contingencies is before the problem happens. And so that goes back to the value of whole resource planning, and the importance of doing that, and the. I mean, just like Ben, you know, started our conversation asking about what's the likelihood that people who have authority will concede any smidgen of that to a group that's going to work in the public interest. And that's where you folks come into education and advocacy for whole resource planning. And that's very much what's needed. I mean, there's no question. I'll just tell you, there's no question that some water could go from the Tennessee River to Atlanta. I'm an expert on that, and I know that's at some cost. Now, the cost there's an energy cost, there's an infrastructure cost, there's a question about whether it makes sense to do it, and all those may argue against doing it. But if you wanted to take water out of the Tennessee River and put it someplace else, you know, if you pick the days of high flow, the Tennessee River could probably, and you coordinated on a whole watershed basis with the Ohio, the flows that are needed to sustain water in the Ohio and the Mississippi. And if you looked at it big picture, smart people could eventually come up with a plan. But that requires everybody to work together in a way that we don't have. Steve mentioned compacts. I mean, there was an ACF compact. But the ACF compact had a poison pill in it and says if we don't come to agreement, compact disappears. Well, those states never came to agreement. And so the question, how do you get leaders to lead? You know, that's the question of the day. That's the question of the day.
Well, thank you all. Thank you, Paul Davis.
Thank you.